out of the building was just the first step. But that first step was huge, which meant he needed help. At that night's meal, he'd sat next to Thomas and detailed his plan. Thomas wasn't convinced, feeling the effort would bring on the ultimate punishment, which he'd thus far avoided. Aaron had pressed, saying, "Your fate is preordained. It's not happened yet, but it will. Do you think sitting here in this cell is getting you favor? They will kill you the minute they think they can. Maybe the reason you've lived this long is simply the fact that they haven't generated the courage. They will, eventually. I promise." Thomas had said, "I thought you had a friend, someone who would get us out." Aaron shook his head and said, "She's out there, I know it, but we have to work for ourselves, not waiting on some miracle. If she comes, she comes, but we need to plan as if she isn't." Thomas had agreed, with the caveat that he wouldn't allow any of his tribe to help. They'd only provide early warning. That was good enough for Aaron, and he'd set to work. He'd been at it 4 times today, and was close to getting the first brick weak enough to break free. His primary problem was that he wasn't sure if the uniformed tribe wouldn't see his handiwork and alert the guards to curry favor, which meant not creating damage that could be found by them when they utilized the bucket. But that also meant that when he finally attacked the bricks he'd worked, he might not have weakened them enough. A problem for another day. He wasn't near that end point yet, and so he scraped through the next brick's mortar, slowly but surely weakening it, until he felt it could be broken free with force. He pulled out a chunk of mortar and tossed it hard out of the window and into the forest, not wanting anyone passing by to find it. But he didn't worry too much about that. He'd studied what was beyond, and it was woods, with the foliage growing right up against the building, something that would help them escape. He scraped again, and then heard an incessant clanging. He stopped, dropping to the ground. He paused, heard nothing else, and was about to remount the bucket when he heard Lurch screaming in English, "Where is the Jew? Where is he hiding?" The sound of prisoners scrambling penetrated the blanket, the men retreating out of range of the sadistic guard's wrath. He pulled the blanket aside while pretending to draw up his pants. Lurch said, "What is this? You don't feel like you can shit in public? Are we not good enough for you?" Aaron remained silent. Lurch said, "You won't have to worry about your modesty anymore. My general is back home. We had a discussion about you, and I'm pleased to say that he's going to talk to you tomorrow. So prepare yourself." Aaron knew that was pure psychology, designed to eat at him, designed to get him prepared to tell the truth. The nightmares he would conjure in his mind from the threat were to soften him and get him to cave at the first act of violence before they moved on to whatever he'd developed as a worst-case scenario in his mind. It was psychological warfare, and he'd been in such positions before. The statement was ham-handed, amateur hour. Aaron said, "Why hasn't he returned to question me yet? I've been telling all of you that I've done nothing wrong. I demand to speak to my embassy, right now." An innocuous statement that would be expected from an innocent tourist, but it set Lurch off. He became visibly incensed, and Aaron realized he'd made a mistake. Lurch smacked him on the side of the head, hard enough to drive him to the floor, screaming, "You do not make demands! You have no embassy here! You have nothing!" Lurch paced around, wanting to hurt Aaron, but something held him back. He returned to Aaron and snatched his head by the hair, jerking it upward. He said, "I was told not to harm you, so I won't. But that's just for today. Tomorrow night you are mine. And I'm going to have your little bitch with me. Maybe I'll use her right in front of you, after I've had my way with you. He flung Aaron to the dirt and stormed out. Thomas reached for Aaron's hand, helping him to his feet. It's not good to antagonize them. Aaron rubbed his head and said, Yeah, I didn't know that before. Thomas laughed, then turned serious. You are in significant danger. I feel I must tell you that. General Musebo is not a man to cross. There will be pain. Aaron pursed his lips and said, Or it might be a way out. What do you mean? I'm not leaving here without Alexandra, and he's bringing her to the interrogation.
How does that help?
Nothing. Forget I said it. Let's work on the window again. I'm close to creating a hole we can all get through. Thomas saw the absolute conviction on his face and said,
You truly believe you're leaving here, don't you?
Aaron smiled and said, Yes, I am. And I'm bringing you with me. I promise.
56. I felt my phone vibrate, but was afraid to leave Shoshana alone with the target. No telling what she would do. I looked at Jennifer, held up my cell, and glared at her. She nodded. I exited, looked at the screen, and saw it was the task force. I answered and heard, Go secure, calling back in 2. I did as the disembodied voice asked, and the phone rang again. I answered and heard, Colonel Hale wants to do a VTC right now. I said, I'm in the middle of something. Tell him I can't do it. I don't even have a computer here. I'll call him back. The guy on the other end said, This is at the request of Colonel Hale. You'll do as you're told. I grinned, knowing the guy on the other end of the line thought he had absolute power. He believed because Colonel Hale had told him to call that he was above the operator, but he wasn't. I decided to screw with him. I said, Who the fuck is this? Just so I know when I get back to D.C. I heard a spluttering then. I'm just relaying the message, man. He turned human all of a sudden. I chuckled into the phone and said, Hey, I'm just kidding. Tell Yoda I'll be up in 20 minutes. I'm really in the middle of something. Who's Yoda? The man who you told me to call. He said, Roger that. I didn't mean anything earlier. I said, Hey, don't take it personally. Tell Kurt I'll call back in 20. Will do. I hung up, patting myself on the back about solving the problems of the task force, and then realized I had to talk to Yoda. Colonel Kurt Hale, and he was most definitely not going to let me continue. But I was sort of locked in now. We dragged the Indian contact to our Land Rover, and had demanded he take us to the safe house where Aaron had been held. He'd done so, completely compliant, willing to answer any question we threw at him, maybe because we'd saved his damn life, but probably because he was a survivor. We'd interrogated him, and learned quite a bit, not the least of which was that he'd seen Aaron being hauled into the house, along with a female. That was enough to turn Shoshana insane. She wanted to skin the guy alive. Not so much for further information. He was giving us whatever we asked, but because she was still in a bloodlust. She kept repeating that he was holding back, but I doubted it. Especially since she was standing in front of him with her wrist coated in blood and ocular fluid from the man she'd killed. We knew that Aaron had been held in this very house. It was the closest we'd come, but he wasn't here now. The Indian told us that he'd been taken from here, along with the woman. Taken to Lesotho. Apparently there had been a high-ranking member of the Lesotho military at the house, and he'd demanded to take them with him, to protect what they were doing. There had been a fight about it, with some blonde-headed South African saying it was a mistake to take him. He'd wanted to hold the man and woman here, then let them go, after. I knew it was Johan. The Indian said that he'd lost the argument because what they were doing was too sensitive, and the man from Lesotho believed the captives were holding out on information. The blonde had said he'd told all he would tell. He knew nothing. Shoshana had asked,
"How did he know that? Who did the questioning?"
The Indian had looked at her and said,
"The blonde man did. It wasn't pleasant."
And I knew that was Johann, too. Shoshana heard the words and snarled, spitting nonsense, not even able to get out a sentence. She wanted to eviscerate the Indian with her bare claws, which she could do, as I'd just seen. I stepped in at that point, pulling Shoshana into a hallway, out of view of our target, saying, "Killing him won't do anything for Aaron." She vibrated in front of me like a shaken soda can, waiting on someone to pop the top. I saw the signs, because I'd been there before. I said, "Stop it right now. Calm down."
"He knows where Aaron is. He knows. He's just not telling us."
"He knows what he's seen, that's all. He's not part of the plan." She curled her fingers into fists and snarled,
"I'm going to fucking kill him right here, right now. If that's all he has in his head, then it's time to punish him."
She was on fire, like when she ripped Stanko apart. I grabbed her shoulders and she began to fight back. I slammed her into the wall and said, "You want Aaron back, for real? Or do you just want to kill everyone, because you're Carrie?" She quit fighting, saying,
"I'm no longer Carrie. I don't like that call sign anymore. I'm not the Pumpkin King. I'm married now."
The comment made me want to punch the wall in frustration. I couldn't even keep up with her changes. I spluttered, "You just said you wanted to fucking kill him. Carrie fits perfectly. So does Pumpkin King, for that matter. Or maybe I should just settle for plain old crazy." The Pumpkin King was a reference to what I'd called her in the past, when she'd first started having feelings for Aaron, but wasn't sure how to attack it. She was just like the main character from that ridiculous Tim Burton movie, The Nightmare Before Christmas, trying to be something she wasn't. It fit then, and she'd only gotten worse since. She was still trying to pretend she was something else, because she thought if she faked it hard enough, it would magically come true. I said, "You are the Pumpkin King. That's not going to change. But it doesn't matter. You've succeeded." She said,
"What's that mean? You still think I'm a psycho?"
She glanced down at the ground and said,
"They all do."
I drew back and said, "You never watched the movie, did you?"
"No, why would I? You were just making fun of me."
I laughed and said, "Jesus Christ, woman. Why do I use movie references if you won't even watch?" She started to worm away from me, saying,
"I've had enough of this."
I pushed her back into the corner and said, "Hang on. Stop." She bristled and I said, "You want to kill him because, when you peel back the layers, it's all you know. That's the Pumpkin King. But you don't need to lash out anymore. You said it yourself. You're married now." She looked confused at the turn of the conversation, and honestly, I was just winging it. I was in an enemy safe house interrogating a known target and talking to a crazy woman to keep her from killing him. Someone I cared deeply about. This sort of shit wasn't taught in the top-secret leadership technique school we had. I said, "You wanted to talk to Jennifer, and I know why. You're afraid that you're different from her, that you can't be like her because of what's in your heart, what you've done. You want her approval, as if that will change you. But you don't need it. She isn't better than you, just different. You are what you are, and it's good. Aaron knows it, and that's all that matters." She spit out,
"Unless he's dead."
I said, "He's not. He's just not here." She looked up at me, boring in with her weird glow, and said,
"Do you really believe that? Or are you just trying to keep me from killing that man?"
I said, "I believe it." She seemed surprised and said,
"You really do?"
"I do. He's alive. He's Aaron. Honestly, I wasn't sure before. But when this guy told us he'd been brought here for interrogation, that upped the odds to about 90%. If he wasn't killed outright, then he's alive." I saw the words give her strength, and she said,
"Will you help me? When the task force says to stop."
Jennifer entered the hallway, blessedly interrupting. I said, "Who's on Mowgli?"
"Brett, he's fine. What's going on here?"
I said, "Nothing, we're just talking." Jennifer became canny, saying,
"About what?"
I said, "About not killing everyone we meet." Jennifer said,
"Unless they need it."
Shocked, expecting support, I flicked my head to her with a glare. I said, "Nobody's killing anyone here." Jennifer said,
"That's not what I meant. Some people need killing, some people need something else."
She moved to Shoshana and said,
"That man doesn't need killing, does he?"
Shoshana became subdued. She shook her head. Jennifer turned to me and said,
"But Shoshana needs something else."
I sighed and said, "Okay, okay. So we go to Lesotho. One more link in the chain." Shoshana glowed at the words, then leaned in and whispered into Jennifer's ear. Jennifer looked at me and nodded. I said, "What was that all about?"
"She wants to go back in with Mowgli, to wring him dry. She thinks he's keeping something secret."
I looked at Shoshana and she gazed right back at me. She said,
"No vendetta. I saw something in him. He's lying about something."
"You saw something, huh? As in a Shoshana vision? Or the Pumpkin King?"
"Shoshana. I saw it. Let me go back in."
I slowly nodded, saying, "No Pumpkin King unless I ask for it, understood?" She grinned and said,
"I'm not the Pumpkin King. I told you that."
I'd let her back in to do her magic. And now Kurt was calling before I had any answers to his questions. Except for the one about where I was going next. And I knew he wouldn't like what I was about to tell him.
57. Colonel Kurt Hale entered the communications center, finding the duty officer with a scared look on his face, and none of the computers showing an active teleconference. Kurt said, "So, Pike coming up here on BTC or what?" "Sir, he didn't have a computer. He said he'd call back in 20 minutes. It's been about 15, so he doesn't have a computer? I did a BTC with him yesterday." "Sir, I don't know what to tell you. He said he's busy." Kurt nodded at the young communications man, clearly aggravated. The man caught the look and said, "Sir, I gave him your message." Kurt smiled, saying, "I know you did. Not your fault." What he was thinking was, "What the fuck is Pike up to?" He turned to exit the room and heard, "Call coming in, sir. Call from Pike." He rotated around, letting the man do his work with the call, although he wanted to snatch the phone out of the guy's hands. The man said, "I'm not sure he's here. He might be at dinner." Kurt smiled, knowing what was about to happen. The man heard the answer over the phone and said, "Okay, okay. No reason to get violent." He turned, his hand covering the mouthpiece, and said, "It's Pike, and he's not in a good mood." Kurt took the phone and said, "Probably because you put him through a dick dance after telling him to call." The duty officer said, "I was just following protocol," but Kurt had already turned away, saying, "Pike, I need a VTC. We have authority and I need to brief you." "Sir, I can't do that right now. I'm in the middle of something, and my computer's at the hotel." Kurt heard the words and felt the proverbial hair rise on his neck. He said, "In the middle of what? You were going to Durban for Alpha. Why don't you have a computer?" "Because I'm in the safe house that Aaron was taken to. I have the man who provided it. He's a subcontractor of Tyler. He knows what's going on." Kurt felt his head about to explode. He put his hand over the mouthpiece and said, "Get George Wolf in here right fucking now." The man at the desk said, "Sir, get his ass in here. I need some adult opinions before I lose my mind." The man scurried out of the room, and Kurt returned to the phone saying, "Did I just fucking hear you right? You have the man who owns the safe house in your possession, and you're interrogating him?" "Yes, sir, but it's not what you think. We were following Stanko, using the intercept you gave us, and Stanko tried to kill him. We interdicted and ended up with the safe house guy. After that, it seemed prudent to question him, since we were already involved. Kurt was apoplectic. You do not have any Omega authority in Durban. You were supposed to continue Alpha. Alpha, you damn Neanderthal. Pike bit back just as hard. Sir, did you hear what I just said? What the hell do you guys think we do out here? Let me make it plain. Stanko had a garrote around the guy's neck. He was about to cut his head off with a piano wire. We fucking stopped it. We have authority to do that, remember? No task force authority will preclude an operator from preventing the loss of life or self-defense of the operator involved. All we did was prevent the loss of life. Kurt said, you may have just screwed our ability to continue. Well, any operation you want to do is predicated on this guy's information. So fire me. Kurt took a couple of deep breaths and then said, we have Omega for Tyler Malloy. The Oversight Council wants you to take him down. Kurt heard nothing for a moment, then, okay, but I have to go to Lesotho first. What the hell are you talking about? Sir, the trail leads to Lesotho. That's what he's doing. I need to explore that, then I'll take him down. Even with the encryption making Pike's voice sound robotic, Kurt heard the conviction. Kurt said, Pike, no Lesotho. I need you to return to Cape Town and conduct an Omega operation immediately. What's the rush? Is there an immediate threat? He's getting nuclear triggers for the sale to the highest bidder. And that appears to be Hezbollah. He heard a scuffling in the background, then Pike saying, stand by. He waited for an eternity, and George Wolfe entered the room saying, what's up? Kurt said, I'm telling Pike about the Omega authority for Tyler. And he's giving me excuses about Lesotho. I don't know why. George nodded, then said, you do know why. It's about Aaron. Kurt said, I don't give a shit about Aaron. I care about Americans. George said, maybe Aaron is the key to that. This isn't a damn democracy. He's got a mission now. George smiled and said, you know what makes us great at the end of the day? Loyalty. Sometimes the individual takes precedence over the crowd. Kurt looked at him for a moment, then said, saving Aaron isn't going to bring us Tyler Malloy. Tyler Malloy isn't the issue. Stopping the triggers from being transferred is. We got Tyler. Those triggers are still out there. Waiting on someone else. All I'm saying is, hear him out. Kurt nodded, and Pike came back on, saying, Shoshana just learned that the operation in question is a coup in the country of Lesotho. It's a small country that, Kurt interrupted, saying, I know where Lesotho is, Pike. I don't give a shit about it. Pike said, well, you should. Because these fucks are going to take over the country with the help of someone in the South African military. Kurt said, and? What's the and? Why do I, as the task force commander, care? Pike said, from what I've seen, Tyler Malloy is fronting the logistics for the effort, and his payment is the nuclear triggers. Okay, you're agreeing with me. Take him out. Tyler's getting paid by the people in the coup. We upset that, and he doesn't get his payday, but those triggers are still out there. Let me interdict the coup, and I'll get the guy who owns the triggers. I'll get them off the table. Hearing George's earlier comments echo, Kurt glanced at his DCO and smiled. Kurt said, this is all about Aaron, isn't it? Tell me you're doing this for the United States instead of an Israeli assassin. Pike said, sir, it's the same damn thing. Kurt said, I want Tyler down. Pike said. You'll have him. I promise. Kurt said, stand by. Then put the phone on mute. He looked at George, saying, how far out are we willing to obstruct the Oversight Council? They gave us Omega, yet we determine how that's executed. I could plausibly say that the only way to effect such a thing was to go to Lesotho, but you and I know that's bullshit. George said, it'll all be in how you brief it. At the end of the day, the greater problem is the nuclear triggers. I say let him go. There will be a mess, but nobody will care if Pike's successful. We have Omega authority. Let him use that to bring this whole fucking thing down. Kurt said, but you know that's a lie. I can't hide the fact that I told Pike to take down Tyler and then let him go to Lesotho. If the end state is that Tyler loses his triggers, then you've succeeded. And you might free Aaron in the process. Sometimes the little things are, in fact, big things. Kurt nodded, then spoke into the phone. If I were to agree with this insanity, what do you need from me right now? Kurt could tell Pike was taken aback. He heard nothing for a few seconds, then said, Pike, you there? Pike came back, saying, I need an airdrop of an Africa package, the ones with the motorcycles. I'll set up the drop zone, but I need you to get the package in motion. We don't have a lot of time to waste. Kurt said, and? How are you going to prevent a coup in Lesotho with a couple of motorcycles? There's only a small team of mercenaries that have set this up. I've confirmed a high-ranking Lesotho military man is involved in the conspiracy. So I'm sure the manpower is from the Lesotho Defense Force, with the Mercs providing the leadership. Take them out and take out the coup. Can you do that with only 3 people? I have 4, actually. Shoshana's with me, and we know the location of the safe house they're going to use to stage. Hit that thing, and we might get them all, to include the lead on your triggers. Kurt looked at George, knowing he was now stepping over the line. He said, you'll have 6. Knuckles and Veep will be in that bird with the package. They're at DJ right now, and the L-100 is with them. Once again, Kurt could almost hear the gears turning in Pike's head. Finally, Pike said, what the hell are they doing in DJ? Kurt said, for the life of me, I don't know. I put them there because I figured you were going to do something stupid, and I needed some sanity on the ground. If I get them moving now, I can have them overhead by midnight tonight. Is that enough time to find and establish a DZ? Yes, sir. That'll be the easy part. You said you had the L-100? Is it still capable of a Fulton recovery? Yeah, why? I've got to make this guy we have disappear, or he might compromise everything. Pike, I can't authorize an extraction for a citizen of another country who's not a terrorist and not an imminent threat. There are boundaries to my authority. Okay, I'll just have Shoshana kill him. She really wants to. Kurt clenched his fist, trying to crush the phone. He said, all right, fuck. I'll include a Fulton recovery package. You are really testing the limits here. Pike said, I know, but it'll be worth it. Pike, don't let me down. I'm hanging it way out here. I won't. Trust me, this way is harder, but in the end, it'll be a much better solution for everyone. Kurt smiled and said, I know. Stop the coup and prevent the triggers from ever being transferred. Yes, exactly. And bring Aaron home, right? Pike said nothing for a moment, then Kurt heard, Right, sir. Thank you. I won't let you down. Kurt heard the words and knew he'd done the right thing. Pike was a supernatural predator, and he would move heaven and earth to save Aaron. And between him and that goal was a planned coup of an entire country orchestrated by a highly trained mercenary force. Kurt almost felt sorry for them.
58. I took a wind reading and saw that, while it might be kicking higher than safe above the ring of rock outcroppings, once the team got low enough, below the stone wall, they'd be able to pilot the parachute safely to Earth. The wind in this area was constantly whipping, a continuous scream across the hard scrabble ground, and it had caused trouble as we tried to find a drop zone. We'd located a few patches of terrain large enough for a night drop, but the key had been finding one that was protected from the wind. Well, that, and one that was hidden from all the damn backpackers running around. We were at the foothills of the Drakensberg mountain chain, about 3 hours west of Durban, and within striking range of the border of Lesotho. The problem was that Lesotho was called the Mountain Kingdom for a reason, and the terrain was incredibly rugged. At an altitude of 7,000 feet, which was pretty damn high, and we hadn't even crossed the mountain chain yet. Deep in the Mkomazi Wilderness area, a national forest not unlike Yosemite, was an outdoor enthusiast's dream, with hiking and mountain climbing up peaks with names like the Rhino's Horn, and four-wheel drive adventures to the Sani Pass, the latter reached only by taking a daredevil switchback gravel road straight up the chain of rock, ending inside Lesotho at the Sani Lodge, and the highest pub in Africa. Americans like to think of themselves as the Wild West outdoorsy types, but they have nothing on South Africans. I don't know where else in the world cage diving with great whites would be advertised like a Ferris wheel ride, and this national forest attracted adventure seekers of all types. Because of it, the area was dotted with lodges both primitive and luxurious, offering everything from fly fishing to mountain biking, which made our mission that much harder to conceal. While I most certainly would have liked to take our Land Rover straight up the gravel to the Sani Lodge, hoisting a beer at the end, we needed to get inside Lesotho without going through any form of immigration. I had no desire to leave any scrap of evidence that we had been there, because I was sure we were not going to remain clandestine. We were going to get in a gunfight and then disappear. When the inevitable investigation occurred, I didn't want them to have a lead in the form of a customs stamp or border crossing tax payment, especially since we had no cover for action whatsoever. While Lesotho, like most of the world, held enough archaeological work to allow us to plausibly execute a Grolier cover, to include even actual dinosaur tracks, we'd had no time to establish it, so I was looking for a clandestine penetration. I tasked Brett and Shoshana with finding the crossing, while Jennifer and I found the drop zone, with an eye to infiltrating the country that night. It was certainly an aggressive plan, but we would readjust if we couldn't meet it. There were a lot of things stacked against us, but we knew from Mowgli that the safe house in Lesotho wasn't due to be occupied until the following night. So if we had to wait, we'd do so, using the next day as another reconnaissance day. Shoshana wouldn't like it, but I wasn't going to sprint forward into a foreign country and possibly get arrested as coup plotters just because she was antsy. Jennifer came back from the far side of the field and said, "No obstacles. There's a creek on the left, but it snakes away from the field." I said, "No roads, no houses?" "Not that I could see. And I want a good 500 meters. "Okay, then. This is it. Let's go back, send the grid, and check what the dynamic duo found." We walked about 20 feet, and she said, "You think Knuckles is going to have a problem with the ridgeline? If they miss the spot, they'll end up on top of that plateau, and we have no way to get to them." I turned and looked, seeing an escarpment about 100 feet high. It was a little tight, but I said, "We don't know which direction they'll be coming in from. Look at the bright side. If they come the other way, and the spot's off, the plateau will stop them when they run into it." She scowled at me, and I said, "Not my fault. You did the DZ survey." I opened the driver's door and saw Mowgli in the back, shackled to the anchor point of the seat. There'd been no way I was going to leave him at the resort to create mischief, and I didn't want him riding with Brett and Shoshana as they tried to penetrate the border, so he came with us. Well, that and I wasn't sure Shoshana wouldn't just beat him to death and leave his body on the side of the road. He started to speak, and I said, "Rules, Mowgli, rules, no talking, or I pass you to Carrie." He scowled, both at his given call sign and at the fact that I wouldn't let him present his case. He was adamant that all he did was provide the safe house, which was true, but it was enough. From what I could see, he wasn't a bad guy, as far as assholes go. More like a simple con man, intelligent, loquacious, and smooth. He'd probably been fleecing tourists at the age of 5, which was precisely why I had brought him with us, and was enough of a reason for me to keep him quiet. Leaving him in our resort cabin would have been asking for him to escape. We drove through the backcountry on dirt trails, crossing streams and cutting across fields until we eventually hit a 2-lane blacktop. After another 30 minutes, we were pulling into our chosen lodge, and not a primitive one, I might add. No way was I sleeping with a mosquito net and no power. I'd probably be using a rock for a pillow in the next few days, so I figured the task force could pay for the night at a lodge with a spa. And I actually had some reasoning behind it. We'd rented one of the cater-yourself cabins, meaning there was no maid service. But it was expensive enough that nobody would come investigate when we didn't show ourselves for the next couple of days. Money would guarantee some privacy. I saw our other Land Rover and said, "They're back. Let's see what they found." Our cabin was at the end of the row, in a cluster of 4, down the road from the main lodge facilities. It was 2 stories, and only looked rustic on the outside. Inside it held every convenience of a modern home: stove, fridge, television, minibar, Wi-Fi, and 4 separate bedrooms. I walked up the steps, forcing Mowgli ahead of me, and Shoshana opened the door. She started to speak, and I held a finger to my lips, pointing at Mowgli in front of me. She nodded, but she was smiling, so I knew it was good news. I took Mowgli to the back bedroom and handcuffed him to the bed. He started to say something, and I held up a hand, then closed the door and returned to the den. Brett was on the computer, working something, and Shoshana was eating an apple. I said, "Okay, what do you have?" Shoshana looked at Brett, and he said, "Go ahead, it was your idea." She smiled, and I could tell they'd clicked on their little adventure. Brett had always been wary of Shoshana, like most normal humans, but he seemed to have warmed up to her, which was good. She said,
"There is no damn way we're crossing through the mountains. It's just too rugged. We could do it on foot, but that would take days, and we don't have that time."
I said, "Come on, there are hiking trails all over the place, all of them big enough for a bike."
"Yes, and we looked at a bunch of the most promising ones, but all the trails, at one point or another, go to literally pulling yourself up rock escarpments, some with ropes. For the most part, they're easy walks, but every damn trail we researched had at least one choke point that prevented its use. We aren't riding a bike up them, and going on foot is a non-starter. We won't reach Maseru for a week, and that's hoping we can get someone to pick us up as hitchhikers."
"So what are you saying? We need to use Basani Pass and just risk getting caught after?" Brett said, "No, Shoshana found another way, one that's not really advertised. There's another border crossing near here called Bushman's Neck, and it's not even manned with immigration folks on the Lesotho side. Just police."
"What is it?"
"It's a crossing that allows the Lesotho folks to enter South Africa to sell their wares. It's got a road that leads to it on the South African side, but there is no road on the Lesotho side. Just a mule trail. It's pedestrian only."
Shoshana said, "But it's a trail that a motorbike could use."
I said, "What about the police?"
Brett said, "The South African checkpoint is about 100 meters away from the Lesotho side. We can get around the South African post by using the trails instead of the road. We've already marked them. Once we're beyond it, we can use the road to get to the crossing. The South Africans restrict anyone coming into their country, but Lesotho doesn't have a lot of security on their side. Really, who can blame them? What person wants to sneak into Lesotho?"
I looked at Shoshana and said, "You learned that in the West Bank?"
She grinned and said,
I'd like to say that, but it was the guy at a coffee stand. Brett wanted some water, and I struck up a conversation. That's all it was.
I nodded, thinking the single-night infiltration might actually be possible. I said, good work, really good work. This might actually have a chance now. She nodded and glanced at Jennifer, liking being part of the team. Jennifer grinned back, and I said, we need to send in the coordinates for the drop. We've got about 4 hours to get them prepared. Brett said, I know. I was talking with Blaine Alexander about the operation earlier. He's on the ground. I said, wait, what? Kurt said nothing about him coming. I didn't really mind Blaine taking charge, because it would relieve me of any responsibility when I went apeshit. But I was already trying to sneak in 6 people on motorbikes past a guard force. One more was asking a bit too much. Brett laughed and said, he's in DJ. He'll control from that location, trust me. We could use him. I nodded, relieved, and said, yeah, you got that right. Get him on the line. Brett dialed up the VPN, and I saw Blaine on the screen. We'd worked together for years, and I truly liked and respected him. I just didn't want him on a motorcycle behind me, dragging one more person on the operation, but he would understand that. He'd commanded every task force team in existence on an Omega operation, and yet he said the same thing he always did as soon as he saw me. Pike Logan, I was hoping it was you. Looking forward to working with my favorite team. As always, I said, I'm the only team that ever makes you look good. He chuckled and said, so, I get pulled from Molly by Kurt, from a luxury resort tracking a terrorist with Johnny's team, I might add, to live in the barracks at DJ as a contractor. Thanks for that. Johnny sends his love, by the way. Axe said you're a dead man because their mission is now on hold. Good to see I'm helping keep the officer corps in tune with the common man. He laughed again and said, I'm told we got the Africa package you wanted. 6 motoped survivals, along with a Fulton rig. You ready to execute? Sir, I am, and I'm glad to hear your voice. You ready to do some good? Hell yes. From what I hear, you're about to stop a bunch of assholes from raping the local folk. Doing some real good. Which was the first time I'd actually considered the full implications of the coup. Before, it had been all about the nuclear triggers and Aaron. I'd never considered the innocents who would be harmed by the action. But what he said was true. I said, prepare to copy the DZ information. And then went into a long diatribe of signals, markings, and everything else I could think of. I ended with, you sure they got the bikes in the package? It's not standard kit in the Africa package. He said, I have no idea, but I was told so. I just got here. I'm playing catch-up. Which was a little confusing. Why not just go to the bird and check? Not wanting to insult him, I said, where's Knuckles? Can I talk to him before he launches? He said, Pike, the bird's in the air. It's close to an 8-hour flight. Knuckles left with the package at 5 local time. He's been in the air for a couple of hours. He was in the air before I landed. Shit. Although I knew it inherently, I'd failed to calculate just how far away Knuckles really was. Kurt saying, I've staged them in Africa in case you need them, made it seem like they were close. But they weren't, any more than someone saying I've staged them in North America, and the team was in Calgary while I was in Texas. I said, so. Knuckles gets a true blind combat drop. Better him than me. Blaine said, first time for everything. Now, let's get to business. Give me the plan. Kurt mentioned nuclear triggers, and apparently I'm supposed to do something about that. I laughed, liking his attitude. Yeah, there's an asshole who's getting paid for this coup with cast-offs from Project Circle. He'll get his as soon as we're done. Blaine nodded and said, and there's a bit of a hostage rescue in here. Kurt's packet mentioned an operator down, an Israeli who's part of the mission profile. I couldn't believe it. Kurt had made that part of the profile? I glanced at Shoshana, and she couldn't either, her eyes wide. I said, yes, actually there is. An Israeli friend of the task force who stopped a nuclear attack in Brazil at the World Cup, you remember? He said, I do, and Kurt does as well. You ready to get to work? I looked at Shoshana,
and she had her hands held to her face, like she'd just found out she'd won the lottery, which she had. I said, "Sir, you don't even need to ask." 59. 5 hours later, we were back at the drop zone, waiting on contact from the aircraft. We had no way to talk to the pilot directly, but with a little bit of planning, we could hear him, through our rental car's stereo, no less. Along with the coordination measures for the jump, I'd passed Blaine an AM frequency on the end of the radio dial, which the aircraft would use to transmit in the blind. So we were all sitting in one Land Rover, waiting on the aircraft to give us a disembodied voice like some Mexican radio station skipping across the atmosphere. After about 10 minutes of static, which is annoying the hell out of everyone in the rover, we heard a squelch. Then, Prometheus Pike, this is Shadow, looking for a rope. Brett bailed out of the rover as the pilot repeated the request. He began shining an infrared laser into the sky, weaving it back and forth like a cowboy swinging a lasso. The radio blurted, "Got the rope, confirm the rope, coming in north to south." We all exited at that point, the tension growing. We couldn't see the aircraft, but we knew the risks involved with what was about to happen. The radio said, "First pass away, jumper's gone." We stared into the night sky, trying to identify something that would tell us they were okay, but saw nothing but the stars, which honestly I expected. We wouldn't see a damn thing until they opened their canopies, and maybe not even then. We waited for 3 minutes, and then Brett, wearing nods, said, "I got him." He pointed away from the escarpment and said, "I got 2 good shoots. Which was the only thing I cared about. Get past the risk of mechanical failure, and the rest was up to the jumpers. The parachutes circled lower and lower, working turns in the sky. I could tell they were fighting the winds, Knuckles probably wondering how on earth I'd told him it was a safe DZ. They circled right above us, then turned into final approach, heading straight into the wind and the escarpment. They dropped below the protection of the wall of rock and immediately picked up speed from the forward thrust of the parachute. The first jumper yanked the toggles of his chute deep, burying them to his waist in an attempt to flare the parachute. But he still hit the ground hard enough to roll into a parachute landing fall. The second one saw the damage from the first and adjusted early, landing upright. I ran out onto the DZ, finding Knuckles sputtering. He said, "What the fuck? This is the best DZ you could find? The fucking wind is like a tornado. Then it disappears completely." I pointed at the second jumper and said, "He didn't have a problem." Knuckles shucked his chute and said, "I'm about to kick your ass." Instead, he fist bumped me, happy to be alive. I returned the bump and laughed, saying, "Save it for the bad guys. Can you get the bundle in?" "Yeah, pretty sure I can." Veep came running up, saying, "Holy shit, that was some serious wind." I said, "Yeah, well, not serious enough to prevent you from landing on your feet. You must be a SEAL, right? Only they could do that in this situation." An Air Force Special Operations member, Veep, looked at me, then Knuckles, unsure of what to say without aggravating either of us. Knuckles said, "There will come a time, Mr. Badass, when you'll regret the disparagement." I said, "Don't make it now. You know, because of the winds." He grimaced, and I turned serious, saying, "Can you get our package in safely?" "Yeah, I can do it. No thanks to your planning." He pushed a switch on his chest and said, "Shadow, Shadow, we're on the ground. Give me a time hack." He listened for a second, then said, "8 minutes, he's circling." I said, "You saw the winds. Can a carp release get the package here, or are we going to go hunting it?" Meaning, would the onboard computer in the aircraft be able to determine an accurate release point, or would the parachute land 2 mountains over? He smiled and said, "You know better than that." He pulled out a device that looked a little bit like a gaming controller. "Money is no object to the task force. He's releasing a Firefly." I nodded, giving a silent sigh of relief. You never knew what technology you'd get in the field, but the drop zone I'd selected would need some serious precision, and the Firefly was exactly that. Basically, some smart guy had looked at JDAM GPS-guided munitions and said, If we can drop a bomb with that precision, why can't we do the same thing with a parachute? And they'd built one. The Firefly was a container system with a ram air parachute coupled around a GPS guidance system that would read the winds and adjust all the way to the ground. Which would be fine in a normal situation, but ours was a little different. If the GPS computer did its job, the bundle would smash into the plateau once it cleared the break of wind, as had almost happened to Knuckles. Luckily, we could override the system. Knuckles touched his ear, then said, "Bundles away." I looked into the sky and saw nothing for a moment, then caught a flash of dark against the night sky. The canopy was open, much bigger than the one Knuckles had used. Knuckles let the computer do the work as the load came to Earth, looking at his screen, then back in the air. He did that repeatedly until the bundle was about 500 feet above the ground. He started working his handset, pushing the parachute to fly slower than it wanted, given the winds at altitude. He brought the bundle over the drop zone, and it sank into the lull of the protection from the mountains, causing the parachute to surge forward at full thrust, headed to the rock wall. Knuckles worked his controller, and the parachute sank to the ground like a child dropping a hanky off a table, right in front of us. The container thunked hard, and Knuckles contacted Shadow, telling him the spot was good and to release the second one. 5 minutes later, he heard, "Second bundle's away. I say again, second bundle's away. Standing by for extraction." Knuckles repeated his prime video game skills, and the container hit the ground right behind the first. We raced out to break them down. Inside was a veritable Jason Bourne wet dream, 6 motoped survival cycles, a complete communications package, enough cases of MREs to live for a week, high-tech beacons and other surveillance kit, and weapons. Blessed weapons. I withdrew a Glock 23 pistol and saw immediately it wasn't task force. With a custom-stippled grip, a Trigicon RMR holosight, and a flat black widened magwell, it was much more of a race gun than we usually used. I held it up to Knuckles and said, "Shot show worked out for us?" He said, "Yep, ZevTech came through. Every pistol in that case is tricked out. We're supposed to be testing them on the range, but I figured a real-world event was good enough. I got to shoot one before I flew today. The trigger is about as crisp as anything I've ever fired, and it's very accurate." I grinned and said, "Looking forward to testing it." He said, "From what I'm hearing, that won't take too long." He withdrew the Fulton recovery system, which was really nothing more than a giant balloon attached to a wire, which itself was attached to a thick full-body suit. He said, "Where's your man?" "In the vehicle." Knuckles said, "Veep, let's get this in operation while they break down the kit." Veep helped him take it to the center of the DZ, then laid out the components of the kit. I went to the Land Rover and unlocked Mowgli, saying, "Time to take a ride." He had no idea what was about to happen and looked genuinely scared. I said, "Don't worry, you won't be harmed, and you'll get a hell of a story to tell your friends." I brought him to the center of the field and delivered him to Veep and Knuckles. They forced him to put on the bodysuit, then slapped a helmet on his head. Knuckles said, "You ever seen a video of someone getting hoisted up by a helicopter?" Mowgli nodded, and Knuckles said, "This is the same thing. Just hold on to the cable." Veep inflated the large balloon and let it fly, the cable snaking out of its bag as it went higher and higher. The concept was old, and a little bit crazy, but it worked. Basically, our L-100 would drop its rear ramp and fly right into the cable, capturing it with a special collection device. Mowgli would be yanked into the air, swinging behind the bird, where the cable would be snagged and he'd be winched up until he was pulled into the back of the aircraft. I heard Shoshana say,
"What the hell is this? Who called this thing a motorcycle? More like a moped."
To Knuckles, I said, "You got this?" "Yeah. Get my bike ready." I left them to their work, going to Shoshana. She'd pulled out what looked like a mountain bike with a very small engine crammed into the space between the top tube and the down tube, and a small gas tank behind the handlebars. It was flat black, with a luggage rack behind the seat, a saddlebag on the left, and a gas can on the right, making it look like it was created for the set of The Walking Dead. called the Motoped Survival. It could be pedaled or driven under power and was robust enough to go just about anywhere, but light enough to be carried over obstacles if necessary. She said,
"This is what we're taking to Lesotho?"
I said, "Yep. It's got a 400-mile range, and we can kill the engine and pedal straight past your Lesotho police station." I saw Brett and Jennifer breaking out rucksacks, inventorying the gear. Jennifer pulled out a PWS MK-109 long gun from a case, a piston-driven M4 derivative with an integral suppressor chambered in 300-caliber blackout. She slid it into the custom-built holster on the left side of the bike, then bungeed her rucksack on the rack behind the seat. Eventually, all six bikes were outfitted, looking like some Hollywood Westworld contraptions for a movie. Knuckles shouted, "Final pass!" And we all turned to watch. Mowgli was sitting on the ground with his legs in front of him, clinging to the cable for dear life. He turned to look at me, and was jerked violently off the ground. One minute he was there, the next minute he was climbing into the sky like he was on an invisible express elevator. Knuckles waited until he got the call. Then he and Veep came back to us. He said, "Successful recovery. Bird's gone. We're on our own now." I nodded, and Brett passed out preloaded magazines for both the Glocks and the long guns. I said, "Okay, last chance at the kit. Everyone got what they want?" Outside of directing a bare minimum of equipment, weapons, night observation devices, and an extremist mechanical and explosives breaching capability and communications, I'd left it up to the individual operator to determine what he or she wanted. I let them dig through the containers one last time, then directed them to store anything sensitive that we were leaving behind inside our Land Rovers. While that was being done, I had Brett and Veep break down the parachutes from the containers, taking them across the stream and stashing them in the thick brush, then breaking the containers down into pieces. If we were lucky, a local would come along and simply steal them. The entire preparation had taken about 3 hours, which meant we were running into dawn, and I wanted to be through the border crossing and at a campsite we'd located on the Lesotho side before then. Even so, I was pretty damn proud of what we'd accomplished. Not too many military forces on the planet could have conducted a halo insertion, complete with equipment and a Fulton extraction in a single cycle of darkness. I directed Jennifer and Shoshana to take the equipment-laden Land Rover back to our lodge, parking it out front. The other, empty Land Rover, would return with them and remain here for the duration, hopefully not getting stolen. While we waited, I briefed Veep and Knuckles on everything I knew. I turned it over to Brett, and he briefed our infiltration route. An hour later, now closing in on 4 a.m., Shoshana and Jennifer returned, and I got everyone together for a final brief and a comms check. I said, "Okay, Brett and Shoshana have the lead. We cut the engines at the South African checkpoint, pedal our way past them, then do the same on the Lesotho side. No lethal action. If anything happens, if we get compromised, then we evacuate and regroup. Got it?" They all nodded, and I said, "Brett, your show." We fired up the bikes, and they were a hell of a lot louder than I expected, like six lawnmowers attacking a small patch of grass. Brett circled his finger, and he led us out of the DZ. The night split by our headlamps. I brought up the rear, and the sight of the caravan racing toward the border brought a grin to my face. Missions like this were the one thing that made me feel alive, testing the boundaries of my skill. And the kit was pretty damn cool, too. The only thing that would have made it better was if a couple of velociraptors were racing alongside us.
60. After entering the gate to their borrowed training compound, Johann directed the driver to the front of the barracks. He jumped out of the cab, went around to the back, and said, "Andy, have the men break down the kit. You take Chris to the medic. I'm going to find Colonel Armstrong." Andy nodded and said, "I don't think it's broken. He'll still be good." Johann went up the steps saying, "We'll see," over his shoulder. He entered the barracks and went to the office in the back, hearing voices. He knocked and waited. Armstrong came outside, closing the door behind him. He said, "What the hell took so long? It's almost 4 in the morning. The damn driver couldn't find the drop zone, even with a GPS. He was supposed to be waiting on us when we hit the ground. We got nothing. The stand